A former F-15 test pilot and MASH unit EMS director, Dr. Bradstreet, is a veteran of many different disasters.
I'll just explain a little bit about how I wound up here. I was in the Air Force. I spent a significant amount of time working on disaster preparedness with the military. Went to combat in some of the secret wars in the 80s, back before CNN followed the troops around. And had some unusual experiences with some things like Hurricane Andrew, where I was one of the first responders on scene for that disaster. And I'm going to share some of that with you and some of the lessons from that today in a way that I hope will inspire you to reevaluate where you're at. Where you're at personally. How many of you are physicians? Is this entirely physicians? Okay. How many are you not physicians? That might be easier. So most of you are not. Okay. So most of you are not. Some of you are. Some of these details are going to be deliberately graphic, and I know there are some younger folks in the audience, but even for some of you who are a little more seasoned, I want to help you understand that things like war and some of these disasters are pretty brutal forces, and I don't think you can learn about them from the 6 o'clock news. And having lived through them and taking care of the consequences, I can tell you that we are generally ill-prepared, both emotionally and society-wise, to deal with these. This is kind of some of my history. I dealt with an epidemic of Shigella dysentery that took 2,500 troops out of the deployment force in Egypt. And that was one of the secret wars in 83 when Gaddafi invaded Chad. How many of you remember that event? It's an interesting bit of history, but about 7,000 U.S. troops deployed secretly to Egypt and set up a base. It was the largest deployment of B-52s and of two air wings since Vietnam at that point in time. But we lost one-third of our fighting force, our potential fighting force, to dysentery. And I'll go over some of the details. Actually received a humanitarian service medal when Bethalto was destroyed by a tornado. We had 250 casualties, only two deaths in that. And it was a December tornado, which is a very weird time of year.
Where was it destroyed again?
Bethalto, Illinois.
Oh, Illinois.
In Illinois, yeah. And then I was a child living in Indiana when one of the worst disasters and the most costly of tornadoes wiped out big portions of that state and saw my hometown destroyed. Called the Palm Sunday tornadoes. There have actually been two Palm Sunday series of tornadoes. And as I mentioned, I was a first responder to Hurricane Andrew. I was on the disaster response force and a leader for MAC headquarters. And I was the director of emergency medical services for the 5th MASH, which doesn't exist anymore, but I was a MASH doctor. And I can tell you, it wasn't quite like the TV show. And I feel like I'm a first responder in the pandemic of autism, and Dr. Roman will talk about that later, and I won't bother to go into that because my son has autism and have worked a lot with the autism community lately. And then have dealt a lot with the HIV epidemic or pandemic. So a little bit of history there. I had an unusual military career. I was a test pilot as well as a flight surgeon as well as an emergency medical director for the military. So it was kind of a fun gee whiz. And this is the fun side of the military and the fun side of combat, getting to fly these fancy jets and having people pay you to do it. We're going to go over some not-so-fun stuff. So the real question this morning is your family, home, business, or community, or state, or country prepared for natural disasters and or war, which are unnatural disasters? How many of you have a fully established personal disaster preparedness plan that you're comfortable with right now for yourselves? One, two, three, maybe four, maybe. Now, I live in Hurricane Alley, so I do. We have a couple of buckets, two generators, enough gas to get us through several days, large supply of fresh water, unperishable food that can still be consumed. Some of the stuff that, you know, like the military used to give us to eat was hardly consumable, but... I think most of you are at risk. All of you who didn't raise your hands are literally one step away from the Stone Age. Most of society is one disaster away from the Stone Age. And having lived in these kinds of events, I can tell you that living without water pressure, without flushable toilets, without electricity, without cell phones, without telephones, the only thing that you could communicate to the outside world with was the SATCOM, and that was it. Now, imagine yourself living in that for 3 days, 7 days, 10 days, 14 days. And some of the delay in getting power back, was, recently demonstrated by the hurricane that breezed through the mid-Atlantic states, kind of going slightly south of Washington. Some of those areas were 14 to 21 days without electricity. So the assumption that this is a three-day plan, I think, is inadequate, and we'll go over that. There are some resources. FEMA and the American Red Cross have some nice stuff on the web, but they gear themselves around a three-day response. So you have a three-day bucket, and I can tell you that a three-day bucket will leave you empty after 3 days. There'll be nothing, no resources. And if people haven't gotten to your community by then, you'll be in trouble. So think more along the lines of 7 days. I think that's a better safety margin. But see what the hospital is doing, what their disaster response team is, and most of them have those, what they're capable of, what kind of history and experience do they have. Has anybody ever been in a disaster? And, you know, there's a lot of people who are responsible for disaster preparedness in communities who've never seen one. They've never been in one, they've never experienced it, and they are woefully ill-prepared when it finally comes their way. Some medical organizations are very adept at dealing with this. State of Florida, because of Andrew, has developed some very specialized teams and resources and stockpiles to be able to handle this. Many states have not. There are federal and private resources like the Red Cross who can help out in these kind of situations. And having been on scene in Andrew, it was 3 to 5 days before places like the Red Cross had much of any impact at all. And this is from the FEMA website, and they just talk about some of the things, flooding, earthquakes, hurricanes, wildfires, those sorts of things. How many of you have actually experienced a significant natural disaster in your own right, in your life? Again, maybe half of you, 35% of you. Preparing for the worst and hoping for the best is kind of what this is all about, but individual requirements, many of you have, and many of your communities or the people you may be looking after could have very special needs. As an example, the nursing home population, people with medications, certain disorders and diseases that require a lot of attention, even people, as an example, who require electronic life support or electric wheelchairs and things like that to get around. It becomes a disaster for them very quickly because they can't recharge their wheelchair, they can't keep their batteries working on various sorts of things. Think about a neighborhood plan as well as a personal plan, regional plans, and then what your risk levels are. So if you live in Southern California, you don't have to worry a whole lot about hurricanes. But earthquakes, wildfires, mudslides, those kinds of things are fairly routine around here. And just as a distribution, is this a fairly broad selection of the country? People from the East Coast, raise your hands. There's a few of those. Those are the hurricane folks. And people from the West Coast? Most of you. Okay. How many of you are from the middle part of the country? Those are all the tornado people. And Hawaii. Hawaii gets some interesting hurricanes and volcanoes. We're not going to deal with volcanoes, but there's a long list of potential natural disasters. But investigating community preparedness, and generally speaking, I will tell you, it's going to be community ill-preparedness. If you really put a microscope to what they're able to respond to and what they're actually capable of, and you start to look at something more than just a sheet of paper that says what they're supposed to do and find out if they can really do those things on the piece of paper and how experienced the people are who are going to carry out those plans, it's usually ill-preparedness. And again, FEMA talks about a three-day plan. I would recommend a seven-day preparedness bucket, and it's going to take usually two or three buckets in your garage. Set aside for that if you still have a garage after the disaster. Figure out what the depth of local hospital resources are, and they're often very shallow. This is the land of HMOs. And because of cost containment, most hospitals have very limited backup resources in the event of a disaster. And we learned this firsthand with Andrew, where the hospitals were stripped of IV solution in a matter of days and couldn't get resupplied very quickly. And federal weaknesses, the stockpile of medications required for disasters, and we'll go over some specifics, and for plagues and things like that, is very weak at the federal level. IV solutions, as an example, we deployed to the Middle East. We had an epidemic of 2,500 cases of dysentery. We had enough IV solutions for five. That's all they gave us. And it wasn't under our control. The physicians who deployed didn't get an opportunity to tell the government what they wanted, what we wanted in our deployment package. That was determined by somebody else in the military. So communication along those lines can be quite awkward. And I see some little kids coming in, and I will warn you in advance, because this is a discussion of war and disasters, there will be some things that aren't appropriate for little kids. So think about yourself as being one disaster away from the Stone Age. Now, many of us as physicians have become very dependent on our MRI scanners to make diagnoses. In a disaster, you're back almost to Boy Scout level of medical care very quickly. So ability to improvise and do things that are outside the box is not always an intrinsic skill for physicians who have lived their whole life living by the rules. And all of a sudden, the rules are gone because the things that you depended upon to carry out your task are missing. So no telephones, no cell phones, no water pressure, no gasoline, which we're close to already. And that really, the gas shortage in the United States, because of a lack of refineries, it tells you that it wouldn't take very much pressure on the system to be without gasoline, which doesn't sound like it's that bad of a deal, except we're very dependent upon transportation. No street lights. And I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about traffic lights, really. No traffic lights, which was an amazing disaster in Hurricane Andrew, because people don't know the rules that when the traffic light is out or doesn't exist because it's been blown into the next county, every street's a four-way stop. But nobody knows that. Literally, nobody knows that. So there was traffic accident after traffic accident because people were just barreling down the street. They didn't see a red light anywhere. Boom, run into somebody. I mean, that's the level of lack of preparedness that we have. And as this picture says, no roads. It's amazing, but the roads may be there, but they may be impassable because there may be a building lying on them or junk cars or freighters. There were freighters from some of the hurricanes that were 30 miles inland because of the storm surge, 20, 30, 40-foot storm surge. Doesn't seem like it's that bad, except a lot of the Gulf Coast states, 30 feet is, you know, the top of most buildings. They don't get 30 feet until you're like 150 miles inland sometimes. So you can see tremendous disproportionate damage. So what do you know about earthquakes? The largest, one of the worst disasters earthquake-wise is frequently thought of as either Alaska or the San Francisco earthquake of 1908 or the subsequent San Francisco earthquake that happened just a few years ago. In fact, on a proportionate basis, one of the worst disasters that we ever had was in South Carolina, in Charleston. The entire city was almost destroyed in the mid-1800s. Did you know that? Charleston, South Carolina, earthquake?
There's a big one in Missouri about that time, wasn't it?
We've also changed the course of the Mississippi River several times because of earthquakes in the Central American Fault. So the idea that earthquakes are exclusively a West Coast or Pacific Rim phenomena is not true. And in fact, I'll show you some ideas about this. Now, you can see that in the very high regions, which are in black, includes California and Nevada, but look at those mountains, central mountain and northern mountain states that are well removed from the coast. In fact, the largest caldera in the world is Yellowstone Basin. It's where the magma, the hot stuff inside the earth, is the closest to the surface. But look at the central United States. That's that mid-U.S. fault. And then the entire East Coast is at moderate risk of earthquakes. Something nobody even thinks about. And I guarantee you, the East Coast states do not have an earthquake preparedness plan. This just shows the seismic activity around the Pacific Rim, but it includes the United States. But look at the amount of activity that's occurring, you got your way here, along the East Coast. I think you can see that fairly well. Central and East Coast activity all the way up through Maine, through the Appalachian chain, is rather significant. It typically does follow the ranges. It's the Pacific, and particularly the Asian side of the Pacific is much more at risk than we are, but we're not obviously without risk, and everybody talks about the big one in California, which hopefully won't happen during this talk. This is, and if it does, I will be ill-prepared because my bucket's in Florida. This is San Francisco. Just gives you an idea of what happened to the downtown district in 1908. Now, we've improved a lot with the structure, infrastructure of buildings, and there's new codes for new construction, but there's a lot of old construction that's still out there that's very sensitive to earthquakes. This is Alaska, and you can just see that it was devastating in places along the Alaskan coast where the town just was in massive upheaval. And this is a school, and you can see that it's fractured, broken apart, and if that happened during school days, it could be obviously disastrous. That's a fairly significant quake, I'd say. Let's move on to hurricanes. working for Safer Communities. This is from FEMA. Hurricane Floyd was the largest evacuation in peacetime in the history of the United States. It was a Category 5 storm when it was about 150 miles off coast, but rapidly, when it hit cooler waters, degraded to a Category 3 storm when it came ashore, thank God, because it's probably the largest storm ever recorded. And that's a picture of it right about landfall, and you can see that it is the entire east coast of the United States in terms of size. It was a massive storm. And I was living in Central Florida at the time, and we looked at the satellite pictures, and the eye wall was 150 miles away from my house, the Category 5 winds. Fortunately, it just went right up the coast. And, you know, people who live in the Carolinas are really experts at hurricanes. Nobody has an old house. Nobody has an old medical practice because they get rebuilt about every 5 to 10 years. I talked to a pediatrician up there who's a friend of mine, and he just said, well, we just, you know, rebuild every 5 years. It's like, keep getting something new all the time. That's a picture of Andrew at landfall. Andrew was a very tightly wound storm. And unlike Floyd, which was the entire East Coast, you can see this one is just South Florida. Very tightly wound storm, very dense, and it didn't have a lot of rain with it because it was so tightly wound. But the wind pressure with Andrew greatly exceeded what was recorded, because by the time all the anemometers were blown off the roof and the National Weather Service lost their radar, their anemometers, basically the building was cleaned off for all of its sensors, they were recording 165 mile an hour winds. Now, it came ashore as a Category 3 to 4 storm, but it must have spawned some significant tornadic activity, and I'll show you some ideas about this. There were only 42 fatalities because, unlike things like earthquakes and tornadoes where you may have a brief amount of warning, we had days to prepare for Andrew. However, you cannot evacuate South Florida. We've learned that. The highways will not support evacuation, mass evacuation. With Floyd, we learned that Central Florida could not be evacuated either. And people didn't know exactly where Floyd was going. Do you go north or do you go south? Which way do you go to miss the storm? So there was confusion. The civil authorities didn't really know where the storm was going. People tried to go to the central state or the west part of the state to try and get away from it. And I don't think I have a picture of it, but the I-95 and all the escape paths were parking lots. Hundreds of thousands of cars that couldn't go anywhere. So people had left homes and were trapped inside cars with no resources. They didn't have emergency supplies with them. You know, we interviewed a lot of those folks, and they basically were out there, for all intents and purposes, naked, with a Category 5 storm brewing. Had it come ashore with everybody sitting in their cars on I-95, it would have been an absolute catastrophe. There were 160,000 people left homeless after Andrew. That's amazing. This gives you an idea of Andrew winds. That's somebody's roof plywood, or the plywood that you put on your windows. It's hard to know where it came from. Actually driven right through a palm tree. That's not 145 mile an hour wind damage. That's 220 to 240 mile an hour wind damage. That's a 2x4 driven right through a palm tree. So the typical types of things you think about with preparedness, are you prepared for that kind of stress, that kind of wind force? This was one of the southern villages around South Florida. Gives you an idea of the amount of devastation. Didn't matter if it was concrete block, frame, or mobile home. Andrew was not selective. It could destroy anything. In fact, some of the big department stores that were tilt wall, concrete tilt wall, with steel trusses, the steel trusses looked like spaghetti. The tilt walls were blown off because when the roof went, the wall pressure was not designed to handle an assault from those kinds of winds. And you can just see parts of frame of houses and the level of devastation. When I arrived on the scene with Andrew, we went down as part of Broward County's response force, which is the county north of where the disaster occurred, because everybody in Miami was incapable of responding. I mean, if you've been through this, the psychological trauma, the sleeplessness, the abuse that the storm has put upon you, pretty much makes you, as a local individual, incapable. 16-foot storm surge. 16 foot of ocean coming into South Florida. And it really didn't matter the type of structure. These buildings are basically just blown out. They're gutted. Winds went all the way through and destroyed them. This was a very dramatic tornado. We're moving on to some more wind forces. But this was, how many of you actually watched this evolving on television? I was just absolutely amazed that this was, for hour after hour, they watched this F5 tornado moving through central Oklahoma, and it was absolutely devastating. And I lived through these tornadoes. Destroyed the town that I lived in. Fortunately, we had a concrete block home that we were in the basement for it, but when we came out, there was nothing, literally nothing left after this series of tornadoes. Killed 137 people, 1,700 were injured, and $30 million back in the mid-60s of damage, and just town after town after town in the Midwest was devastated. The strongest winds ever recorded were 286 miles an hour in Wichita Falls, which is where I was doing my military officer training school at the time. And Wichita Falls was pretty much destroyed. Parts of the downtown area and the mall area were destroyed in 1979. 3,000 homes, 20,000 people were left homeless, 60 people were killed, and 1,700 were injured. And it's a little town with a little hospital and very little capabilities. This is an excellent satellite picture of wildfires in Southern California. How many of you lived through a wildfire? There is nothing that you can do to stop it. You can't even breathe after a while. If you're downwind from it, you can't breathe. The fire becomes so destructive and so hot that people can't even get close enough to try to put it out, and it winds up pretty much having a life of its own until it extinguishes itself by burning up all of its fuel. And this is a closer in view. This is right outside of San Diego. And these were pictures that were taken just a few months ago from the satellite. And there are some great resources that the government has to kind of look at this. But you can see that it's basically burning through all the green stuff, and when it burns it all up, it will eventually just extinguish itself. We don't think a lot about tsunamis, but some of the worst devastation in our country happened in Alaska as a result of tsunamis. The Pacific Coast Rim, however, deals with it a lot. We actually had a tsunami hit Daytona Beach, which was pretty wild and weird. It went all the way through the downtown. It washed cars 3 and 4 blocks away. And it was only 1 foot of water until it hit the beach. But it was traveling at about 85 miles an hour. That's what makes tsunamis so incredibly powerful. Tsunamis can move miles inland. They've hit some of the Pacific coast, Pacific Rim islands with tremendous force. And there's nothing to say that California, Oregon, anywhere along the Pacific coast couldn't have a tsunami. Like I said, we've even had them on the East Coast. Let's move on to plagues. Most of us, when we think about plagues, think about the Black Death that went through Europe in the 1400s, and it was clearly awful. What is the worst plague that's ever hit the world that we know about? Does anybody want to take a guess?
Spanish flu.
Spanish flu is the right answer. Spanish flu killed more people than HIV, and it's killed more people than bubonic plague, and on a relative basis was one of the most devastating things that's ever happened, and it was a 1900s. This is kind of what doctors think about plagues. Stick the other end of this in your mouth and say, we don't really want to get close to it. This is scary stuff for doctors. And in the context of plagues, if you go back and look at the history of the medical response to plagues, I don't think we've done a very good job in general. And I'm going to give some critiques for us. This is the graph on the left-hand side of the screen is fairly typical of what happens with most plagues. They rapidly take out all the at-risk population. Now, what was so strange about Spanish flu was that the at-risk population were the young, healthy people. This is the pandemic flu from the early 1900s. So it wasn't the babies and the old and infirm. It was the young, healthy people that you needed to run society that were the most vulnerable, strangely enough, to the flu. Now, we know with plagues that the furry little thing in the bottom of the picture there is actually the culprit, but it's not the rat itself, but the fleas and the Yersinia bacteria that the flea carries that are the big issue. But you see a rapid rise and then a fairly rapid fall. And the only thing that changes is the distribution of time on the bottom of the graph. So is it months, weeks, years, decades in terms of the at-risk population? Things will eventually calm down. For those of you who aren't doctors, this is some of the early signs of Yersinia pestis, the buboes that start to occur and what the bacteria look like on blood smears. And I thought that we pretty much had plague under control. But look at the graph. The dates are the 1996, and you see that there's a very rapid, steady rise in the incidence of plague in Africa. And plague is becoming epidemic again in Africa.
What's the ordinance that we can't read it?
It's a little fuzzy, and I apologize. This goes from 1954 on the far left-hand side. It's really dark for you. And 1996 on the far right-hand side.
And the vertical
ordinate is the...
And then the number of cases are on the y-axis. I'm sorry, it goes up to 7,000 cases at the very top. Sorry, forgive me. Didn't understand. And this is probably one of the worst brewing plagues that may actually wipe out the entire population of some countries in Africa. And this is HIV. And the dark areas of the screen are areas that 15 to 39% of the adult population are infected with HIV. That's the black areas. Very widespread. Just as an example, the United States and Russia, it's 1 to 5% of the adult population that are infected. And in the United States, generally good medical care, good access to the anti-HIV medications, fairly good survival statistics. However, in Africa, there's very limited access to HIV drugs, and the fatality is extremely high. And you can go into villages in Africa, and you'll see grandma taking care of babies who have, the babies are infected with HIV. Grandma's not. Grandma's the only person left in the village that still doesn't have HIV. And this is the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. And they threw together all these warehouses to put people into and makeshift hospitals out of tents. If you go back and look at the medical history of this, it was amazing. They wound up in places like Philadelphia and in San Francisco with the streets lined with pine wood coffins. And there was nobody left to pick them up and transport them. Just massive fatality rates.
What's the fatality rate? Did half of the patients die?
It varied. And it was actually more devastating in Europe because of the crowding in European cities compared to the United States. But it was pandemic through both sides of the Atlantic. And in some places, 30% of people who were infected died. And this is the... 28% of all Americans were infected at one point in time. This is from JAMA. Back in 1918, 28% of all Americans had the flu. And this is how they actually refer to it. Influenza affected 43,000 servicemen trying to deploy for World War I. Couldn't deploy because they had the flu and were sidelined. 1918 has gone, a year momentous as the termination of the most cruel war in the annals of the human race, a year which marked the end of, at least for a time, of man's destruction of man. Unfortunately, a year in which developed a most fatal infectious disease causing the death of hundreds of thousands of human beings. Medical science, for 4.5 years, devoted itself to putting men on the firing line and keeping them there. Now it must turn with its whole might to combating the greatest enemy of all, infectious disease. So they were marking the end of World War I and talking about what they felt was actually the worst of the fighting, which was pandemic infections. Worldwide, the mortality rate for the full pandemic for the 4.5 years or 5 years that it was sweeping the world was between 30 and 40 million people. So are we prepared for pandemics? And the answer is decidedly no. How many of you have at least a 30-day supply of anti-influenza antivirals in your cabinet? So there's a couple of smart folks running around. You may be the only people who survive if another bad pandemic like that comes back, assuming that the new strains are sensitive to the drugs that we currently have available. How many of you have a month's supply of Cipro? More of you have gotten turned on to that lately. Does the United States government have a stockpile of antivirals ready to meet a influenza epidemic? No. We're dependent upon vaccinations. And if you haven't been paying attention, let me just let you know. Vaccinations for flu always miss. We're a year at least, sometimes 2 or 3 years behind on guessing what the new strains are going to be. And there's not a lot of evidence that being vaccinated to the wrong strain helps you. So we should be focusing our attention on antivirals because they work. The antivirals really do work. We ought to have a huge stockpile of antivirals, and we don't. During the last flu season, I can tell you that pharmacies quickly were stripped out, and the suppliers were not able to do this. And the way pharmaceutical companies are now preparing medications, they do a batch production and then shut down. So they make a batch of drug, and they'll shut down that part of the plant for a while to save money until that batch starts to be used up. Well, in an epidemic, the batch is used up in a week. And then they have to try and re-gear production, which takes usually 30 to 45 days before you're back into the pipeline with the medications coming back out.
How about shelf life for that kind of medication?
It's years.
It is?
Years. And actually, if they really studied it, the FDA usually puts a two-year shelf life on everything. But some of these drugs at reasonable temperatures would be good for decades, probably. So you wouldn't necessarily have an issue where you had huge investments that you had to turn over every couple of years. But you could rotate stocks, and you could get this out into the community. There's lots of ways to deal with that. But there is absolutely no plan for that. Should be pretty good. Again, at reasonably cool temperatures, it ought to be several years, 3, 4, 5 years or so. It will, you know, I don't know how many of you know this, but when our meds expire, missionaries go around to doctor's office asking for expired meds because they still work fine in third world countries. We're not allowed to use them here, but they work great for years in third world countries. We have an HMO mentality, which is where we're trying to get the cost of delivering healthcare down to the rock bottom. And the problem with that is that bed capacity is minimally able to expand. The nursing supply is critically short at this point in time. And simple things like IV solutions. We don't have enough IV solutions for more than about 3 or 4 days worth of epidemic in this country, and it's gone. These are just basic commodities that could be easily stockpiled.
IV solution should be easy to produce.
Yeah, if you have the bags and then the distribution system to get them out. They are. But I'm telling you, in order to keep their costs in the bottom line, they don't have huge stockpiles of IV solutions waiting for the next plague. That's really the responsibility of governments. I don't think these things could be stockpiled, but they're not really available. And every major disaster that I've been involved in, we run out of IV solutions usually within the first couple of days. I have not checked on their production capacity in terms of how much they can produce. This is a little bit of what the issue is. The cartoon says we're trying to streamline things around here, and this is my HMO joke, but you wind up with being so without margin in medical delivery that as a disaster occurs, it overtasks the system very quickly. We're going to give this entire talk to the organization so they can put it on the website. So the details about the medication, the dosing, you don't have to worry about taking notes on. Tamiflu is probably one of the best things. Its onset of action in a flu epidemic is very quick. We had a major outbreak in Central Florida. The doctors in our clinic went on Tamiflu. We never got sick, and we were able to take care of people just fine. We had no side effects, and none of us got the flu vaccine because we don't believe it. We don't think it works. But we had a plan. This is a new drug that's just recently been approved, and it is for children over 7 years of age. Tamiflu can be used down to 3, and obviously if you have a really sick case, we're going to use it down to whatever age we have to. It's less effective when the symptoms weren't severe, which is, I think, great. It's most effective when you're really, really sick. That's an inhaled one, which makes it a little harder to deliver. Flumidine is a very commonly available, pretty effective, fairly low incidence of side effect. You can take it throughout the entire season as a prophylactic, and you can also take it at increased doses if you need to during times of illness and outbreaks. Sinotril is the old line drug that kind of got us started on all of this. It's indicated only for A. It doesn't treat B at all, and it tends to cause a lot of side effects. And we only wound up using this in the last flu epidemic because we ran out of the other better drugs. But we wound up using this, and it still works. But side effects are about 3 to 4 times as high as some of the other ones. Anthrax is treated by either Cipro or doxycycline. There are some disadvantages to doxycycline. in terms of absorption with food interfering with it, and then sun exposure, where if in certain climates that may be an issue. Cipro is very effective, and it does, if taken early, work well as a preventative. If you've already inhaled a massive amount of anthrax dust, you are probably going to need to be hospitalized and get it IV rather than orally. Let's move on to war. We've seen a lot of it lately, but what you've seen is a very sterilized view of war. You've seen, you know, CNN and NBC and those kinds of views of war, and I can tell you from having lived through conflict and having been a MASH physician that that's not what war looks like from the physician's perspective or from the civilian population's perspective. And the fancy pictures of the big bombs going off and all that sort of stuff is very newsworthy, but I want to show you a little bit about what this all means. And this would be probably in the next few slides would be a good time to think about getting the kids involved in doing something else and not looking at the pictures unless you really want them to see these sorts of things. War has enhanced our transport logistics tremendously. So there have been some, war has always brought with it a mixed blessing. Technology has improved tremendously because of war. The ability to deliver services around the country has improved tremendously. We've learned a lot about surgical techniques, about antibiotics and other things as a result of conflict. However, it has its major downside. This is actually a picture that I took through a Black Hawk helicopter when we were in the Middle East looking at the pyramids, which is, this is not a standard tourist view of Egypt. So I thought I might share that with you. This is how my hospital arrived in the Middle East. It came out of trucks, and this was how we got started to build our hospital. So it's truly mobile in the sense that they drop it out of the back of a truck, and then a small army is required to assemble it. By the way, it was 140 degrees midday in the Sahara Desert. And we had one of these on a daily basis. It was my first experience trying to manage medical care in the midst of a sandstorm. But that dust is infectious material. It has, you know, what, 3,000 or 4,000 years worth of camel droppings in it? It is amazing. There is not a scratch that doesn't get infected in this environment. The only place that we had that we felt relatively secure about was a steel box that we had for our laboratory and a steel box that we had for our operating suites that were air-conditioned with filtered air, and we felt we did a fairly good job in terms of keeping those relatively clean. Everything else, everybody, the patients were coated with dust, the supplies were coated with dust, because this goes through every little sieve, and you can't go in and out without bringing just a tons of this in because it's, you know, 40, 50 mile-an-hour winds blowing the desert in your face. Like most wars, dysentery was a major threat. As I mentioned, we lost one-third of all of our troops from an activity perspective because they were down with dysentery. And if you've never had Shigella dysentery, it's awful. In addition to it being 140 degrees outside, most of the individuals had 103 to 105 temperatures. They were literally crapping their brains out. In fact, this is one of the more grim pictures. This is a real photograph I took on scene. And this is the poor guy who was on latrine duty washing out bedpans. So if you can imagine in a dysentery outbreak, dealing with all the bedpans alone, just as a military, trying to clean them, wash them, 140 degrees outside, it's pretty awful. The doctors all had dysentery. And the reason we all got sick was the military got its water from an oasis, and normally we would chlorinate it to sterilize it, filtered out through these Ertilator bag systems. And one night, the shipment of water came in, and the troop who was supposed to do that chlorination process forgot to chlorinate the water. So everybody drank raw oasis water. And it was an interesting experience. All the doctors had IVs in, and we taped IV bags to our shoulder, and we'd walk around with IVs trying to take care of the individuals. And we had, like I said, we had enough saline to take care of about the first 5 cases of dysentery. We had lots of D5W, and those of you who are physicians realize you can't rehydrate somebody with D5W. So the World Health Organization has helped us out and provide us with enough to get us through the first couple days until the Army could fly in some more airplanes and get us more IV solution. This was the depth of our pharmacy. That was it. That was the pharmacy for 6,000 military troops. I can tell you it doesn't go very far in terms of trying to take care of an epidemic. War and civilian preparedness. Some of these pictures are very graphic, and I want you to understand that the type of skills that are going to be required and what happens to a civilian population in war. And it's pretty devastating. We use high explosives, incendiaries. Landmines are one of the biggest threats to the civilian population. But burns are ubiquitous, and we can rapidly exhaust our burn capacity. The supply of silvadine is very limited. That's the silver cream that we use to prevent infections and burns. It's not stockpiled for those kinds of situations. Burns occur in wildfires. Burns occur in all kinds of natural disasters. This just extraordinary skills are required as a physician to deal with some of these kinds of injuries. The effect on the environment is catastrophic. And people who were in the first Gulf War, when the oil wells were set on fire, had tremendous respiratory dysfunction because they were trying to breathe amidst all of this stuff. Absolutely catastrophic. Infectious disease is usually the largest cause of casualties in wartime, not bullets and not bombs. Malaria is an example. There were worldwide, there are between 300 and 500 million cases of malaria every year, 1.5 to 2 million deaths every year. That's just without war. In every military campaign fought in the last century where malaria was endemic, more man days were lost due to malaria than bullets. For example, in World War II, 12 million man days were lost, and in Vietnam, nearly 1 million were lost to malaria.
When do we get that DDT back?
We don't. Dysentery, cholera, those kinds of things. If you look at some of the journals of the physicians from World War II, and you look at the nature of what they were treating, the North Africa campaign came to a stop on both sides because of dysentery. So that was one of the benefits of infectious disease. Actually, both sides of the British, the Americans, and the Germans were so sick that they couldn't actually continue to carry on the combat. So hygiene and care in crisis. Water supply. Unless you have a way to purify water and to filter water, you can assume that in the absence of water pressure, you will have backflowing of toilets into the water supply, and you won't be able to drink the water for days to weeks. And in South Florida, as an example, it was literally probably a month before the water was turned back on in some places. And if you think about it, the plumbing was gone. Some of these houses were destroyed down to the very foundation. There were just raw stubs of plumbing sitting out in many places. So it was a very limited process in getting water supply back. Septic and waste management, this is the number one rule in any sort of environment where you have to take care of large numbers of people, is how do you manage the human waste? And you have to have a plan for doing that. So latrines, moving away from the village or the town or the tents that get set up to try and take care of the, like we had a tent village in South Florida that tried to house the 160,000 homeless people. So that's a rather large rock concert to try and get porta potties to. Think about it, you know? And all the roads were impassable, so many of them had to be flown in by helicopter. You couldn't land at the military base because the runway was scattered with debris and destroyed. Eventually, all those things got taken care of, but with a tremendous amount of effort. Food preservation, when you don't have electricity, you don't have refrigeration, and most people are dependent upon refrigeration to keep the largest part of their food supply going, and then how are you going to take care of that in terms of meal preparation and those kind of things. People don't think along those lines. We're very dependent upon our culture and our infrastructure. And then pest control. And this was a huge problem. Just an enormous problem in Egypt. It was an enormous problem in Andrew. The mosquitoes and the flies, because of all the debris and all the cattle that had been killed and all the other animals that had been killed. I mean, cattle were, and the livestock were floating in ditches. So the drainage ditches were full of debris and dead, rotting corpses of animals. And so from a disease perspective, from a fly perspective, from a mosquito perspective, because now nobody had screens, nobody had a building that was even dry. So mosquito population was out of control. I mean, we went down for ourselves and brought lots of mosquito repellent, and we did okay. But for the population, the 160,000 people without housing, the mosquitoes were, it was just devastating. And in the floods that took place in the Carolinas with some of the hurricanes back in the 1990s, mosquitoes were so out of control that people were recording thousands of bites per day from mosquitoes. Sort of like fishing in Alaska, if you've ever done that. Thousands of bites a day. Air quality. 9/11 taught us a lot about first responders and people who were around that kind of disaster in terms of the effect on their lungs and the ability to breathe. Air quality, whether it's setting fires to oil wells or buildings that go up in smoke, can be a real hazard. And if you don't have a plan for dealing with that, you will become victim of the poor air quality fairly quickly. Protection from the elements, whether it's rain or cold or sun and those kinds of things, when you lose your infrastructure, becomes a very important criteria. Quarantining individuals. American population doesn't take well to quarantines. Getting locked up and put in a separate village where you can't mingle with your friends and family isn't a very American sort of an idea. So there will be, in various parts of the world or in the United States, areas where quarantining due to plagues or epidemics will be required, and people need to have a way of dealing with that. And it will probably take the military to enforce that. And then wound care, I can tell you that simple wounds can become devastating in an environment like this. Some of the unusual things that I wasn't prepared for with Hurricane Andrew was the amount of fiberglass injury that people had. And if you can imagine all that pink stuff in your attic blowing around at 145 miles an hour, your eyes, your ears, your mouth, your nose, every pore in your body has fiberglass driven into it. And one of the biggest things that we weren't prepared for when we went down there was this, how to sedate people who their entire body was itching. They were just going nuts because they had fiberglass everywhere. So it can cause eye damage and a variety of problems, lung issues with chronic coughs due to just breathing the pink stuff in your attic. But wounds were in a environment where the infrastructure is destroyed and you're dealing with all kinds of broken timbers and glass and everything. People are getting cut and lacerated all the time. There's not enough people to sew them back together. I spent most of my time when I was in South Florida sewing lacerations together because they were getting cut on glass and trying to dig out find their belongings and find lost things or lost people. And the lacerations were significant. But they become infected almost the next day. So to summarize this, and I think we'll leave enough time for a few questions, personal responsibilities. Only a few of you actually have a plan in place for how to deal with a disaster if it was to happen in your community. But I can tell you, if we all individually prepare, the burden on society and our ability to take care of one another in the context of a disaster will be greatly improved. It will make you much more productive, much more able to help your neighbor or to be a medical medic or to be a first responder. It will save us a tremendous amount of money and resources. Community and county preparedness is generally poorly funded. How many taxpayers like to pay money for disaster preparedness? They want it. I mean, I can tell you that when I talk to county officials and state officials, everybody wants it when they need it, but nobody wants to pay for it when it's a nice sunny day and there's a gentle breeze. That's not, you know, they don't care about paying for it at that point in time. And they do not, for that same reason, have stockpiles of the kind of supplies and the resources that we need for anything of the Hurricane Andrew sort of catastrophe. And by the way, if Hurricane Andrew had come ashore 10 miles farther north, do you know what the loss of the number of homeless people would be? They've estimated that. We had 160,000 people because it went in south of Miami. Had it gone in right into Miami Bay, Biscayne Bay, it would have been about 1.4 million homeless people. Now, that's a really big tent city. We've already mentioned that we do not have supplies to handle an epidemic of flu, which is the most likely, most severe epidemic that could potentially take place. But we've got all kinds of weird new diseases that are cropping up and making their way over that are likely to become the next round of plagues that we're not even familiar with. So vigilance and surveillance and investing in antiviral research, I think, is extremely important. And we know that vaccines have played an important role, but an insufficient one, because some of these organisms can mutate so quickly that last year's vaccine just doesn't take care of this year's disease. And that's a picture that I took flying over. Who gets that? Got a location? Cape Cod, Boston Harbor. You don't usually see this one. This is from the cockpit of an F-15 at 50,000 feet, but it's kind of a neat picture, so I thought I'd share that with you. You put up with me at 8 o'clock in the morning. You guys actually showed up at 8 o'clock in the morning to look at this really gross stuff. I hope this has been helpful for you, and I've got about 5 minutes or so for questions. And we have microphones that would be helpful. Thank you. Go ahead.
I do all the purchasing for our private cancer offices. So you can imagine there's a lot of sick people with new diseases.
Right.
So I will carefully go from year to year and increase the flu shot, flu vaccination. We encourage our, our population of children, that's all adults and immunocompromised. Too many 3 years ago, I bought enough flu shot for everybody, and we had some extra, and then we were told it was only half the strength. They didn't produce the right amount. So we had little cards and we had to send to all of our patients, bring them back in and tell them they needed a booster. I didn't know what to tell them. This past year, you are right, I predicted the right amount of flu shot, and we had enough, but it completely took us by surprise that it only took care of the flus we knew about. And you're right. So
the flus we knew about last year or the year before?
The immediate, you'd think, because we get it, that it's in the fall when we get it, but up until like January when we're given it, it was enough, but then it wasn't the right flu strain. And then they don't have time to make enough to get to any of the patients that are compromised.
Well, that's why I think in your kind of a situation, it makes a lot more sense to stockpile and have your prescribe for your patients things like Tamiflu in at the time of the flu season.
The Tamiflu they said would not work on our patient population. I can't give you.
I'd love to have a reference for that. As far as I can tell, Tamiflu and Flumidine have been very effective for A and B. In prophylaxis.
But our patients are immunocompromised, and I think they told us the Tamiflu wouldn't cover the new flu strain. That's exactly what we were told by the companies.
And it actually did a great job.
Really? But, don't tell me that. No, I already did it wrong.
Yeah, it really did. I would not be at all surprised if flu organisms become resistant, or the next organism becomes resistant. So, how you doing? Good to see you.
Enjoyed your talk.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for a great talk, which coincides exactly with the aims and purposes of this organization. So, as one of the old timers here, we're really indebted to you for carrying out these ideas. Do you have anything published or written down, or checklists or anything like that that we could propagate or imitate?
What I'll do is I've spent probably a significant part of the last month or so working on researching this. And Jane asked me to write an article for Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons. And I think what we'll do is we'll kind of collate this into a disaster plan that makes sense, and we'll have checklists and kind of a summary to just kind of help you to go through all that and think through it. But again, depending on where you live, it will be a little bit different in terms of what you need to plan for, but we'll try and look at it in a fairly broad scope. Yes?
Hi. About 4 years ago, I read a book called The Man Who Would Save the World, and it was about the life of a fairly maverick kind of guy who showed up at all of these global disasters, Bangladesh and so on. But throughout the book, I was struck by how critical he was of the international official aid organizations.
Yes.
And their inability to bring potable water when it was needed, and Pentene and supplies when they were needed. Did you know of such a person, and are you also critical of international aid organizations?
I've known a lot of people like that, and pretty much anybody who winds up dealing with disasters internationally becomes rather quickly critical. Some other things I didn't have a chance to go into that you need to think about. The ability to bring aid into a region that isn't secure from a military perspective, essentially. But if you look at the guerrillas and the local power, whoever is the potentate of that particular region, all of the aid generally goes to them. So their family and their cronies and their buddies, because they've got more guns, winds up getting all the aid. So it almost takes an army to bring aid into most of these areas to protect it so it actually gets to the people. However, what we've seen in several situations is we start to give the aid to the people go back to their home, and then what happens is the bullies in the neighborhood go around and collect it all from the people in their home because they do it at gunpoint. Now they have all the resources and they sell it back to the people or they extort the people to try and get some of the local resources. So aid is a huge problem. Water supplies, if you look at even in Iraq recently, within the last 6 months, when the water truck arrived, it was swarmed. This happens in Africa, in Ethiopia, in the Sudan. I've been in the Sudan, in Ethiopia. We had part of that whole operation in the Middle East was to take care of special forces that we had in different countries. Again, you know, it doesn't take very long for 100,000 people without water to drain a water truck. You know, and we have limited water trucks. They have to be brought in by airplanes and unloaded off of like a 130 or a C-5 or the new airplane, the new transport airplane. You only get like 3 or 4 water trucks on there, and so it takes a limited amount. There's limited resources. That's why, certainly for yourselves, think about it. Because even in the United States, it's amazing how long it takes resources to get to. As an example, something went out on the radio, and somebody must have told folks that we needed dry clothing in South Florida with Andrew. Well, we had all kinds of Red Cross trucks and everything pulling up with dry clothing. We didn't have a dry place to put them. So, and it rained every day. So all that stuff wound up going into Mount Trashmore, south of the city, where it got burned. So, again, the number of inadequacies in these kind of responses, the list is so long, it's amazing. Yes. I got to get Boyd on here in 1 minute.
Yes. We've had the Y2K preparations. A lot of us still have those supplies. But is there any kind of training going on for, like, say, PBS training for this type of...
I'm not aware of it.
Locally?
I'm not aware of it. But, I mean, who watches PBS anyway? I mean, the only people who are going to watch PBS are the people who already have their 50-gallon drum of gasoline built into their backyard and a year's supply of water and their filters and their year's supply of food, whatever. I mean, those kind of people might watch PBS, but they don't need to because they're already prepared. So, yeah, maybe. This is where it's going to take, I think, some very systematic education starting in school. And FEMA is starting to do more school, you know, trying to teach kids about this sort of issue. But unfortunately, this is one of those scenarios that you almost have to live through at once to appreciate the value of being prepared.
Let this man ask his question.
Okay.
A number of us here are access to energy readers and not medical doctors. Are we going to be able to get Cipro and the various flu things to put away?
You need to befriend an open-minded physician. And honestly... There's a lot of value in making friends with the people who have prescription pads and those kinds of capabilities. So take them out to lunch or something, and maybe you can get some other resources.